Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The arts community is slowly making a comeback after a devastating pause. We'll head outside the city to the foothills to better understand the impact at the Center of the Arts in Nevada County, going 15 months without a single performance. Plus, even though we're rounding a long overdue corner, the mental health consequences of the past year are still very much present. We'll speak with two UC Davis psychiatrists about solutions for the mental health toll on children, as well as the difference between poor mental health and mental illness, and how each is affected differently by the pandemic. But first, as Californians begin to finally enjoy relaxed restrictions, two counties remain in the most restrictive tier, Inyo and Merced counties. Merced County is in the Central Valley, south of Modesto and east of Salinas. Today, however, we're turning entirely to the Eastern Sierra. Along Highway 395, south of Mammoth, are just exquisite, towering mountain vistas, home to the tallest peak in the continental United States, Mount Whitney, and the lowest elevation in the country, Badwater Basin in Death Valley. So let's help you visualize this. Inyo County is the second largest county by size at more than 10,000 square miles. But the county population is among the lowest in the state, just 18,000 people. And Bishop, its largest city, under 4,000 residents, which is home to the beloved Mule Days, which draws tens of thousands of equestrian and Wild West aficionados from all over the world. We're going to get to Mule Days in just a moment, but first we're going to chat with Bishop Mayor Stephen Mahovey. He joins us with a better understanding of the challenges to advance to a less restrictive tier. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having us, for having me.
Well, first off, Mayor Mahovey, did you envision Bishop and just in the entire Inyo County would still be in this position?
Not really. I mean, our caseload has actually been, we've been doing pretty well in the pandemic, dealing with the pandemic in the recent time. Once I started to actually dig into the framework that the California Department of Public Health had set for moving through the tiers, it became pretty clear that it would be a challenge for us to get to be able to move to a less restrictive tier. And I don't know how nerdy you want me to get on this, because I definitely have the background where I can be pretty nerdy, but it ultimately boils down to is that the state metrics that were designed for the blueprint for a safer economy, they were designed with large populations in mind. And so all of the metrics that you see for the different tiers, they are on per capita measures, and the per capita measures are typically per 100,000 people. But as you just pointed out, Inyo County is very unique in that we have a fifth of that population at best. So any one case does skew our metrics in that regard and makes it really challenging to move to a lesser tier. As an example, the state actually recognized this in the fall when they met with a bunch of rural county supervisors, including our own Jeff Griffiths, and they came up with a plan. Okay, well, statistical fluctuations for small counties shouldn't immediately throw them in a super restrictive tier. And they built up absolute number metrics by which you can move to a more restrictive tier. And they did that in the fall. And so we were able to stay with a relatively open economy for a while. But then once the state shut down, they never actually implemented that for moving in the opposite direction. So where it becomes really hard to justify is for a county the size of Inyo, or the population of Inyo County, we need to have fewer than 12 cases per week, 12 total cases in the whole county per week, not per day, to be able to move to a less restrictive tier. And once we get to the red tier, then we can have up to 35 cases in a week, because then the metrics that were in place in the fall.
So nearly apply. Three times that amount.
Nearly three times that amount. And so it makes it extremely hard, especially when you're talking about a county that is so large with such a dispersed population. All of a sudden, one household getting sick, college student goes off to college, comes back home for spring break, gets the household sick, that puts us in widespread. And so those it is basically a number of just small number statistics. And the problem isn't just unique to Inyo. You can see it in all of the other rural counties as well. Our neighbor to the north, Mono County, the home to Mammoth Mountain, they have a population of about 14,000. And they managed to actually squeak in and get into red about a month ago, into the red tier, which is the substantial tier, according to the state. And they would, it's almost near impossible for them to have any downward mobility now, for them to actually move into the moderate stage. They would have to have less than five cases per week. Mm. And last week they had six. Right. And so it makes it really hard to make sense of that particular system. And it is, and I'm hoping that the Department of Public Health is going to revise that this week.
Well, and yesterday I spoke with a local business in town, the Mountain Rambler Brewery. And like many businesses, they were hit the past year. At times they even were worried and they teetered on shutting their doors completely. I'm going to share part of my conversation with Bruce Reed. He's the general manager at the restaurant and the tap room.
I guess challenging to say the least, but you know, I guess our story is not much different than anybody else's. You know, just trying to stay within the guidelines, and you know, also trying to survive and you know, give back to the community and you know, stay afloat. Obviously, it's very frustrating. It's really hard to comprehend. I guess I mean, the cases are, in my opinion, pretty low, in the single digits for the past week or so. And, you know, we can't seem to get out of this purple tier. It's very restrictive.
In the past year, did you have kind of any difficult conversations or concerning conversations of not being able to stay open?
Absolutely. And I think that any business that says otherwise is probably blowing the smoke. But yeah, obviously it's been tough. It's been tough on the business. It's been tough to, you know, see ahead.
You know, and Bruce did emphasize that they're also staying positive, but I would imagine he is just echoing what you're hearing as mayor.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, being in the most restrictive tier, of course, we can only have outdoor dining or takeout. And so our restaurants have been hit especially hard. And we at the city have done anything that we can accommodate. We've relaxed some of the requirements so that some of those zoning requirements so that you could maybe put seating outside in parking lots type of stuff. But one of the main issues that is unique to our town is our main street is a Caltrans right-of-way. So we can't actually close any lanes down to allow for seating in front. And so a lot of our restaurants are stuck. And unfortunately, we've actually had a few that have shuttered for good. And when we're talking about a few, again, small numbers, three might not seem like a lot to many people in a large city, but that's about 10% of our restaurants. And so it's been especially hard for them. And it has placed this really big burden. And like the manager mentioned, he even said, well, our caseloads don't seem that bad. And the reality is that has actually placed a stigma on the county. And in many ways, instead of it being like a scarlet letter, it's except the color is purple. So it's more like a bruising. I interact with many of my local constituents who are like, oh, we're still in purple. It must be really bad. And then I have to sit down with them and talk to them and ask them like, okay, well, what do you think that means? How many cases do you think we're having to justify being in purple? And they're like, oh, I don't know, like 40 or 50 a week.
Well, because I was just looking on the state website, the positivity rate in Yoke County is 1.6% with the 7-day average. So that's even lower than Sacramento County. That's comparable to Los Angeles County, San Francisco County, which are in the orange tier. So, I guess that leads me to the next question, because I did reach out to the state about this. And when they responded, they didn't specifically explain the circumstances of in Yoke County. Rather, they pointed me to the state website, which led me to this. But have you been able to have direct conversations with state health officials?
I actually have. Last week, I had some success. I managed to get a call in with Dr. Tomas Aragon, who is the head of the California Department of Public Health. And so we did, well, let me back up. A few weeks back, we did send a letter to the State Department of Public Health expressing these issues. And we definitely, in that letter, expressed the emotional toll that it's been having. But like I said, I'm a little bit nerdy. So I did go into the statistics and point out some of the numbers that make our situation unique. Yes, we only have 18,000 people, but no other county in the state has their population being dwarfed by tourists. So as an example, Death Valley National Park has on average 1.6 million visitors per year, 1.6 million unique individuals per year coming through our county. But all of the metrics that the state has been calculating have been based on the 18,000 and pretending that we're just completely in a vacuum. So I did express those concerns to Dr. Tomas Aragon, and he was extremely understanding and professional. And he even admitted, like, yes, these are very good arguments that we don't really have a suitable answer for at this time, but I am going to direct my staff to revisit this in particular for rural counties. And that was on last Wednesday. So
with that said, and this is our final question, then we're going to get to mule days. So today is usually when the state updates their tier assignments. Do you think Inyo County is going to move forward into the red tier today?
So I do expect that we would probably move into red tier. But it again depends on, and this, I guess, kind of highlights a little bit of the arbitrariness in some ways. It depends on which day of the week to which day of the week they do the metric. Because last week we had, for the majority of the week, we had less than 10 cases. So that would put us in into the red tier. But we had, on one day, we ended up with a 7-day running total of 13, which would reset the clock. So I am hopeful that today we will get into red, and I hope that they still revise these sorts of metrics so that it'll make it more reasonable for us to be able to progress to the lower tiers.
Stephen Mahovey is the mayor of Bishop. Thank you for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Well, you're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with the city of Bishop and Inyo County along the Eastern Sierra about being one of two counties still in the most restrictive tier. Now, as promised, that leads us to Mule Days, described by organizers as an event the likes of which are held nowhere else in the world.
From the broken hills of Mexico, we took the horses we stole, the Sonora. In the California mines where you gringos dig for gold.
All right, now to help set the scene a little bit, that's a taste of Mule Day's favorite, Dave Stammy, performing The Bandit Joaquin. Now, since 1969, every Memorial Day, Bishop's Main Street just overflows with pride and a celebration for packing season, the Wild West, and a parade of hundreds upon hundreds of mules, not to mention a rodeo. The nearly week-long event draws tens of thousands of people from all over the world, with money in their pockets flowing into the local economy. Mule Days was canceled last year for obvious reasons, but even this year faces some uncertainty. Bobby Tanner with Red's Meadow Pack Station, he's joining us this morning. He is also the driver of the famous 20 mule team featured every year at Mule Days. Thanks for making the time, Bobby.
Thank you for having us.
Well, Bobby, for those who have not been, it's not us, because I have been, and I can attest, it is such a fun event. Can you try and sum up Mule Days?
The mule, first of all, the mule is a very unique creature, and maybe that's partially why Mule Days is such a unique event. A mule is a crossbred. It's a half horse, half donkey. It's a cross between the two, and it's not an animal that people are very familiar with these days. But Mule Days is a unique event that celebrates both the history of the mule, what the mule has contributed to our society, and then also how the mule is used currently. Here in Inyo County, the 20 mule team operated hauling borax product out of Death Valley. Many people probably remember Ronald Reagan. He kind of got his start being a pitch man for the borax 20 mule team for their advertising. And so we have the authentic 20 mule team that shows the history of how mules were actually used, what they contributed to our society. And then at Mule Days, you can take the mule from the 20 mule team, put an English saddle on it, and it'll perform in a dressage event. And that kind of sums up Mule Days, that we have such a diverse group of people that come to Mule Days, both contestants and spectators. So we have people from South America that use mules to pack coffee out of the the high country in South America. We have people from England that use mules in fox hunting contests in England and London and that area. So it's very, very diverse. The packing industry here was a big start for the Sierra Club. The Sierra Club used large mule pack trips to two of the Sierras, which eventually created the Wilderness Act. We have these great wildernesses, Yosemite, the John Muir, Ansel Adams Wilderness. All this stuff is tied to the mule, and we celebrate all those different things that the mule has contributed to society here at Mule Days. And people don't really realize how much mules were used in the development of the United States, the history of mankind. And so Mule Days, it's the most unique event you can imagine, with all kinds of great events, and really showcases how diverse the mule is.
You know, you all had to cancel last year for understandable reasons, but, you know, this is such an anchor to Bishop and surrounding Inyo County. When organizing Mule Days, how much of an impact is it to not only Bishop, but the surrounding communities along Highway 395?
The economy of Bishop, Inyo County, Mono County is solely based on the majority of the economy is based on tourism. And the single biggest event in the tourism industry we have in this region is Mule Days. And so it's a significant hit to the town of Bishop, to the local economy, if it does not happen.
Now, you do have a countdown on the website down to the very second. So it's 41 days until Mule Days, exactly 6 weeks from today. You know, given the circumstances and the challenges, as we just discussed with the mayor about being in the purple tier, hoping to advance to the red tier, what is a successful Mule Days for 2021?
Well, the people that come to Mule Days are from all over. It's one of our biggest groups of people that come to it are hundreds and hundreds of RV people that travel. They're snowbirds. They go to Arizona for the winter. They come to Mule Days on their way north in the summer. And so the in-state, out-of-state issue is really a biggie for Mule Days. Bishop, California, we're right on the Nevada state line. So to say that we can't have people from out of state is once again, it's one of those issues that does not work for a county like this, because we are as much Nevada as we are California, due to our remoteness, a remote location to the rest of the state of California.
Right, just separated by the White Mountains, correct?
By the Sierra Nevada Mountains separate the Owens Valley from the rest of California. And so the closest urban areas we have, where everybody goes for shopping, for airplanes, those kinds of things, is Las Vegas, Nevada, and Reno, Nevada. So we're really a two-state area where we live, and so an in-state restriction doesn't make any sense. Just like the metrics that work for large urban counties do not work for a small county like where we are. Mm-hmm.
Bobby Tanner is with Red's Meadow Pack Station and one of the organizers of Mule Days. Thanks for sharing how special Mule Days is, and I hope it's a big success.
Thank you very much.
Up next, for a lot of us, we're still in a funk. I mean, the past year was a struggle, to say the least. UC Davis Health joins us with some solutions, manageable solutions for our mental health, including children and teens. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You are listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The past year has disassembled our lives, or just flat out turned them upside down. Despite a feeling of a return to a feeling of what once was, the toll of the pandemic is still lingering. I mean, collectively, we were in survival mode, trying to persevere and just make it through to the end. And those sacrifices, the missed quality time, Zoom learning, unemployment, closed businesses, losing loved ones while distant, that is manifested into understandable stress and other difficult emotions weighing in on our mental health, some more than others. Now, to help us guide us through all of this and process that with some solutions is UC Davis Health. Dr. Tara Needham is a psychologist and the executive director of the UC Davis Early Psychosis Clinics. Dr. Amy Barnhorst is a psychiatrist and the vice chair of the community psychiatry at UC Davis Health. Thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Vicki.
Well, I'll start off with both of you. What are you seeing this past year with your patients that you want us to better understand? Dr. Needham, we'll start with you.
Great. So my clinic serves youth down to age 12. We also serve young adults. And I think the piece that we are really seeing, again, with youth who have depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, other psychotic disorders, and PTSD is they just aren't getting care soon enough. And so we're seeing these youth just struggle at home. Families are busy, they're working, just trying to pay the rent. And so what we're seeing when kids are coming in now is they're much more ill than they were a year ago. They need more intensive interventions. And it takes quite a bit more time to get them stable. Many of them haven't engaged in school. They never logged on to their Zoom. So we're really having to, you know, wrap that family up in care in order to get that kiddo and that family back on the right path. So, we just wish we had seen people sooner, but we didn't have eyes. We didn't have teachers. We didn't have counselors, coaches, all of these folks, family members, you know, at the party who said, hey, I'm noticing Johnny seems really depressed. Did you notice, Mom? We didn't have all those eyes. And Mom and Dad and the folks that were in the home did the best they could with what they had. And so we're just really seeing the after effects of that lack of community that our children have experienced.
Dr. Barnhorst?
So I work mostly in crisis and inpatient psychiatry. So I work in the jail and in the ER and in a crisis unit and a psychiatric hospital. And I think I'm seeing some similar stuff to Dr. Needham where people are just generally doing worse. There's a whole spectrum of folks that I see ranging from people with very severe chronic mental illness who spend a lot of their lives institutionalized in a hospital to people who, you know, don't have great social supports, don't have great coping skills, and on occasion when they're stressed, struggle with depression or anxiety or suicidality. But I feel like everyone's been pushed towards the, you know, the more ill end of the spectrum. So people who otherwise might be able to cope with this kind of distress, but only need to come into the hospital, you know, once or twice a year, they're coming in more frequently. People who would never have reached that threshold are now reaching it because they're under so much duress. And the people who have chronic mental illness like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, they're not able to access the same kinds of services and supports they were able to access pre-COVID. And so they're also doing worse.
You know, Dr. Barnhorst, that leads me to my next question. I think it's important to explain the difference between poor mental health and mental illness and how those are affected differently by the pandemic.
Yeah, and that's such an important topic now because this topic of mental health has gotten so much coverage. And if, you know, if COVID can leave us with one good thing, maybe it's really bringing that to the forefront. Most of the folks that I treat are people with serious mental illness. And I know the same is true in a lot of Dr. Needham's patients. These are people with schizophrenia, with bipolar disorder, with chronic debilitating depression, which is, you know, more than just feeling sad. It comes with a whole host of other symptoms. And these are people who really do need medications and therapy and case management and wraparound support and probably will, even in the best of times, for the rest of their lives. People with poor mental health is kind of a more nebulous group, but kind of a gray area in between, you know, doing great with your mental health and having a serious mental illness. They're folks who have trouble maybe regulating their negative emotions like anxiety or anger or sadness. They don't have a lot of resilience and coping skills in times of stress, maybe because they weren't modeled that in their traumatic childhoods. They might drift into unhealthy substance use, have, you know, worse sleep or inability to concentrate. And they might do quite well in the best of times and not have any signs or symptoms of illness. But when they're under distress, like COVID can put someone under for so many reasons, they're going to have a lot more mental health struggles, and they may need much more care during those times. And that group, I think, is really growing because of the fear of getting sick, because of the shutdowns, because of the racial violence of the summer, because of the lack of social supports happening, because of economic concerns about economic stability. And some of the solutions for that group are going to be really different. So as a psychiatrist, of course, I'm a really big fan of shoring up our mental health services, getting more people into therapy, having better medications and treatments, having inpatient beds for people who need them, who are in crisis. But telling a parent of three who's faced with losing their job and maybe their apartment, who has three kids sharing a bedroom with one laptop trying to do Zoom school, who is really struggling to make ends meet, telling them like, well, here, let's get you into, you know, three times a week therapy at $150 an hour, that's not really going to help them, you know, and there's no medication that's going to make them feel better. What they really need, so the solution for a lot of people who are having poor mental health because of the COVID crises right now, their solution is going to be more policy oriented, more socioeconomic. So things like supports for housing, moratoriums on evictions, supplemental income with extended unemployment and stimulus checks. So I think it's really important to recognize the importance of those things in people's mental health.
Dr. Needham, when it comes to children and teens, you stress the need for positive time and attention. What exactly do adults need to do?
It's interesting to hear Dr. Barnhorst's comment here about this mother, single mother of three with, you know, trying to pay the rent, one laptop they're trying to share.
They're all across the country and state.
Yeah, they're everywhere. I mean, even when we see two parents and a grandparent, you know, they are challenged. This is taxing their mental health as well. And so I'm a parent. I have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old. They just went back to school yesterday. You know, I think one of the things I have seen with our parents is just difficulty making time to listen to their children. So I started off by sort of saying we're seeing kids later, and we're seeing many of these sort of, as Dr. Barnhorst was saying, even just children who had some mental health challenges, you know, now having more significant mental health challenges. For parents to try, and I recognize this is such a difficult ask, to give their kids 15 minutes a week to sit down and to listen, not to tell them all of the things they need to be doing, the homework they need to do, the chores they need to do, the ways in which they could be more helpful around the house. I know all the parents want to say those things, but to just listen, to ask them how their day was, to ask them what's been good and what's been hard. Have there been things that have made them feel sad or angry or scared or excited or happy? Like to use those feeling words and to just try to listen for 15 minutes. I think if parents could, and you can break that 15 minutes up to 5 minutes over the week. I like to do it at bedtime. I find that's a time when my kids are a little bit more quiet, but that's not the case for all kids, to just listen. I think they'll pick up on quite a bit of what is going on with their kiddos and hopefully be able to problem solve some basic solutions. Sometimes just hearing the child's story is enough to help with the sadness or the fear. You know, celebrating the things that they're happy or excited about, just having that emotional connection right now will go a really long way for, you know, that child. If something is going on, for you to be aware as a parent so that you can try to reach out. If nothing is big going on, then just for that child to feel heard and connected. You know, I just want to own, this is something I challenge myself, and I recognize that I come to this with a lot of privilege and support. So I understand for my parents, it's really hard. So if they can just give their kids a few minutes each week to listen, I think that could go a long way.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with a UC Davis Health psychologist and psychiatrist about solutions for the strain on mental health given the challenges of the past year. Dr. Barnhart, when separating or differentiating between mental illness and poor mental health, you talked about, you know, the need for it. It could be largely socioeconomic, the need for a moratorium on evictions, supplemental income. But if you're in that position and that's not enough and you're still struggling, are there manageable solutions an individual, a family can do to ease the mental health strain of the past year?
I think there are things we can do. And one of the big things, of course, is just being aware of it and thinking. I think of mental health as a spectrum. And again, I feel like COVID has pushed everybody towards the worst side of that spectrum. And having a sense of when do you cross the threshold where, you know, the general advice to get 8 hours of sleep, eat healthy, get exercise every day and connect with your friends. When is that not going to be enough? I mean, that may be enough to keep you out of a hole, but once you get in a hole, how do you get out? And so there will be some people who started out in that kind of poor mental health area and are under so much strain from COVID that they do get pushed into more of the mental illness area, more of the area where they do need treatment. So knowing where to reach out when you're not able to find the energy and the motivation to try to get yourself out of that hole. Because some people, when they get depressed or overwhelmed or anxious, part of the that illness is not being able to do the things to get yourself out. So telling somebody who's really in the depths of a depressive episode, like, just get up and get 30 minutes of exercise every day and get into a routine and go see friends, like, they can't do that. So they're going to be the folks who need to get professional help and maybe do get into therapy, maybe do start some medications. And if people are having, more extreme problems, maybe even going to an emergency room and getting crisis help or calling the suicide hotlines or one of the crisis text lines that are available. For other folks who are just struggling, I think one of the big things we can all do right now is really acknowledge the hardship of this past year. And one of the strange things about COVID is that, you know, on a day-to-day basis, things don't seem that different sometimes. It's not like the wildfires when the sky is dark and you can't breathe and everything smells like smoke. Things look and smell and sound like they're supposed to. And so sometimes it's hard to remember what a difficult year this has been on so many levels for so many people. And I think for adults and kids, like, acknowledging the hardship of that and saying, yeah, you're not supposed to be doing awesome. I have teenagers myself in high school, and, you know, my standards went from them completing all their schoolwork and doing really well to, I just want you to get through this year, please. just pass this year. Because it's really hard to expect what we expected of ourselves in 2019. Now, it is a totally different world. And I think acknowledging that hardship and messaging, not like, hey, we're all going to get back to normal once we get vaccinated, you know, that's unlikely to happen. I think the message we really want to send is, this was a really hard year and it has changed us. It has taught us some important lessons and we are going to get through it together, but we're going to be feeling the repercussions of this for a very long time.
Well, we are now embarking on a loosening of restrictions we really haven't experienced in over a year. And on the one hand, that's a long awaited welcome. But it's also a feeling of unease for some people as we're gathering in ways that we have just been actively avoiding. How can people cope with this new type of anxiety? Dr. Needham, let's start with you.
Yeah, I think acknowledging that you're anxious about it is first what's important. And one of the things I try to encourage families to think about is, what are you comfortable with? Are you comfortable with just being outside? Do you still want to have masks on? Or are most of the adults in your family vaccinated? Your grandparents are vaccinated. You feel comfortable socializing inside? I think it's really important for families to just know what their choices are, know what the risks are, and make those choices for themselves. There's no perfect solution right now. I think we are all so tired of this, and our kids are so tired of being alone, that we do need to make some choices that will increase our social support. That is a very important piece of mental wellness. And so whichever community or whichever group of people, church, family, neighbors, to find a way to make those connections that is safe and respectful for everyone. So if you want to have a hangout with your neighbors and you want to wear masks and they don't, then be 6 feet apart and allow them to make that choice and you make your choice. You know, I just think we also need to be respectful of each other's feelings right now and not shame each other for the choices that we're making for our families. We know what's best for our family and we should be respectful of each other for making those choices.
Dr. Barnhorst?
I agree with that. You know, it's going to be, like I mentioned before, kind of a new world for us. I know when I got vaccinated back in December, because I work in the hospital, I kind of thought like, oh, I'm going to get my shot and feel like I'm just back to 2019. And it didn't feel that way. It actually felt really kind of scary and anxiety provoking, because I walked out of there and thought like, oh my gosh, now I am part of this new world with very few other people, mostly healthcare providers. And I have no idea what it's going to be like. You know, do I hug people? Do I go on planes? Can I go into bars now? Do I even want to go into bars? And so I think people should be aware that this is not going to be just kind of like a ticket into the world we used to know. This is going to be a big question mark in terms of what are we going to want to do? What is important to us? And like Dr. Needham said, a lot of it's a risk benefit analysis. You know, I have one kid who's really social and wants to go out and see all of her friends. And so for her, the mental health strain of having to stay at home, having to wear a mask all the time, not being able to see people, you know, once folks are vaccinated and cases are down, I'm willing to take a little bit more risks to get her out and do what she wants. You know, I have other friends who are total introverts. They're really into online gaming. They work from home. And there's like the benefit of them going out and going to a busy social gathering was minimal even in 2019. And so why is it worth the risk for them to expose that? So we kind of have this system in our household, almost like coupons. Like, how are we going to spend, you know, the minimal COVID coupons for maximal happiness and mental health? And it's sort of a helpful way to think about it, I think, especially with kids, of like, okay, you can take that risk here, but then that means you can't take this other risk here. And which is more worth it to you? You know, do you want to fly on a plane to go see your cousins? Or do you want to, you know, go into the 7-Eleven, which is really important?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of moving parts, whether it's a family with different children and even different spouses potentially or partners that have different wants and needs and comfort levels, or if it's just social groups. Everyone can have their own comfort level. And if you're uncomfortable, you're not going to enjoy yourself anyways, right?
Right.
Dr. Tara Needham, is the executive director of the UC Davis Early Psychosis Clinics, and Dr. Amy Barnhorst is the vice chair of community psychiatry at UC Davis Health. Thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Still ahead, we're going to head to the foothills and get our creative juices flowing. After approaching 15 months without a single live performance, the Center for the Arts in Nevada County is slowly reopening. We'll talk about how art in Grass Valley is adjusting and surviving. You can join the conversation, too. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag #AskInsight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The arts community is slowly making a comeback after just a devastating pause. Today, we're heading outside the city to the foothills to better understand the impact at the Center of the Arts, self-described as the hub for arts in Nevada County. Located in Grass Valley, the center is really impressive, 21,000 square feet. The facility is home to music, dance, theater, film, visual arts, comedy, not to mention youth arts, education, and literature. Amber Jo Manuel is the executive director for the Center of the Arts. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me, Vicki, and thank you for supporting the arts and just having us have a voice on the radio. It really is thoughtful of you during this time that's been so challenging for so many artists.
Oh, it's important. It's crucial. Well, Amber, I spoke with you last year and learned that the facility actually underwent an expensive renovation, which was completed right as COVID-19 closures began. How did the Center of the Arts manage to survive the past year?
Correct. We opened on March 13th of 2020, which was a great day to open a new performing arts center. But we have survived these past 15 months by the support of our members who have been so generous and so proud that this facility was built in this community. It is a beautiful facility. Everyone is dying to get inside and listen to some wonderful music. We also were very fortunate to receive some support from Nevada County, some CARES Act funding, and also from the National Endowment of the Arts. So that has really kept us going. We've been able to maintain a skeletal staff, administrative staff, so that we continue to broadcast throughout this time. So we knew that the artists were also hurting. We did a bi-weekly series of broadcasting artists in our community. So we got them out on Facebook and out of the community. We provided them with some great video, and hopefully people will buy some of their merch when they see those videos. And that's really what we've been doing. So I wouldn't say we've been closed. We have been broadcasting, but we've been thriving in any way that we can, and we've gotten creative.
Yeah, it's important to distinguish the arts community and facilities in rural areas compared to metro areas and cities. Is this arguably a steeper road on an already vertical climb?
Oh, it is definitely a steeper road in rural communities. So much of the funding that is out there from foundations, which has really been keeping a lot of institutions alive during this time, they are concentrated in urban areas. We do not have as much foundation support. We do not have the same level of large donor bases that you have in urban areas. So here we come off of building this facility that was $6 million, really trying to squeeze whatever funding we can from the community for this capital campaign. And then we head right into COVID. So you can imagine what it is taken for us to keep going during this time. And I just have to thank the community for being so generous. We couldn't be luckier here in the foothills. Our rural community loves the arts, and it shows that we're still here and thriving.
What is open now at the Center of the Arts? Or is anything, or is it open?
Yeah, our art gallery has been open most of the time. So the art gallery is a retail space. And so we've been showing artists most of the time during the COVID times. So you can come in and you can purchase art. We have, like I said, been broadcasting from the main stage, and that's to no audience, but we do have some really cute cardboard cutouts in the seats for people to look at. And we do a speaker series on Sundays. So we're open, you know, online with our online programming, but the building has been closed to the public except for the art gallery.
Looking ahead, will there be outdoor programming this summer?
What a great question. There will, Vicki. We are planning concerts at the Nevada County Fairgrounds. I believe that people will feel safer outside than inside for a few months to be. I don't think we're going to just flip a switch and go back to normal. So we are planning an outdoor summer concert series at the Nevada County Fairgrounds, and it will be beautiful. And we're getting some great artists lined up, and that will be on Saturdays in June and July.
And when do you think that we can expect to go inside a concert at full capacity?
Oh, if I had my crystal ball.
Wishful thinking.
I know everyone asked me that question. You know, I'm thinking in the fall. We know Dr. Fauci said late fall, but our vaccinations have been a little ahead, thank goodness. So that's wonderful. I'm hoping September that we're at 100%. You know, so we hope that will be the time.
Fingers crossed. Well, finally, how are you going to ensure, or, you know, the rural communities, Nevada County is very small and tight-knit. You know, are you talking to your neighbors and people within Nevada County about whether they feel safe and touching base with artists if they're actually ready?
Yeah, excellent question. We are right now surveying everyone in our community about their level of safety that they feel. We have, during the pandemic, developed the streaming broadcasting resource. So we are reaching out to people to say, we can continue this. We can continue streaming our shows throughout 2021 if that makes you feel safer. Because I think the most important thing is everyone still needs the arts in their lives. So if you don't feel comfortable coming to a performance inside, we still want to be able to provide you with the arts in your home. So we'll continue that throughout 2021 because we want to inspire everyone with being able to hear that musician or see that piece of artwork.
I think people will really be looking forward to the fairgrounds concerts this summer.
I think so too. I hope so. It's going to be so different. Everyone will be in a pod that will be like a chalked circle, and you stay in your pod and you can take your mask off in your pod to eat and drink. But when you go outside of your pod, you have to put your mask on. So it'll be a different type of experience, but I think people will be so ecstatic to see live music.
Hey, after the past year, we'll take what we can get, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, right. And we're just so grateful. We're grateful to everyone for supporting us, to keeping our doors open. And we hope that as everybody goes out there, they remember the artist. You know, buy a piece of artwork, buy some merch. Remember to support all the artists that have had a really challenging time for the past year.
Amber Jo Manuel is the executive director of the Center for the Arts. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Vicki. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's it for Insight today. Learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight, or you can catch us wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify included. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Muniz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.